Welcome back to Run the List, a medical education podcast in partnership with McGraw-Hill Medical. Our hosts are Dr. Naveen Kumar, Dr. Walker Redd, Dr. Emily Gutowski, Dr. Joyce Au, and myself, Blake Smith. As a quick disclaimer, this podcast is meant for informational and educational purposes only and should not be understood as medical advice under any circumstances.
Welcome back to Run the List. My name is Walker Redd, and I'm here today with Naveen Kumar, bringing you another GI episode from our recent series. So today, Naveen and I are going to be talking about IBD primarily. And we're going to be building off of the most recent RTL episode on diarrhea. Just to briefly recap what Blake and Naveen covered in the most recent episode, they discussed a patient who is an otherwise healthy 42-year-old woman presenting with 3 months of progressive bloody diarrhea and worsening abdominal pain. They went through a framework of how Naveen classifies diarrhea with a few distinctions, whether the diarrhea is acute or chronic, whether it's watery, fatty, or inflammatory. They mentioned, importantly, considering alarm features or risk factors for etiologies that would be an indication for an invasive workup. And so for their patient, there was high enough concern for inflammatory colitis that they did proceed with a colonoscopy. The colonoscopy showed contiguous circumferential pancolitis starting in the rectum and moving throughout the colon. So the pathology report came back with evidence of acute colitis superimposed on chronic inflammatory changes, like altered crypt architecture. The endoscopist was concerned for diagnosis of ulcerative colitis and rated this as a Mayo score 2. And at this point, we as the team that's primarily seeing this patient and following her, our suspicion was for IBD, and that's now been largely confirmed by endoscopy and pathology results. And so once we have a high suspicion for IBD, we need to think carefully about whether this is more likely ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease. And I have been humbled as a fellow learning that oftentimes you can start by thinking about it as indeterminate colitis. It's not always a clear distinction between the two etiologies. And there's often conversation there. Sometimes the diagnosis does change, but we should initially at least try to come up with what we think is most likely going on. And so Naveen, you know, you have some experience in this area. What is kind of your way that you stratify whether you think UC or Crohn's disease is more likely?
Yeah, Walker, and it's a really important distinction. I think we probably both have seen, particularly maybe on the inpatient setting, patients who were originally diagnosed with ulcerative colitis and went ahead and had a total colectomy thinking that that was the definitive treatment. And then unfortunately, they start then having fistulizing disease or evidence of small bowel inflammation, essentially revealing that they had Crohn's disease all along. So yeah, I think this is a really important distinction. For me, when I'm thinking about ulcerative colitis, I really focus on what's happening in the stool. I think the bloody appearance of stool is much more commonly seen in ulcerative colitis than it is in Crohn's disease. And because they have in ulcerative colitis, the inflammation starting right in the rectum and then moving upwards, they often have this symptom of tenesmus, which is this feeling that you have to go to the bathroom, even when there's no stool in the rectal vault. So I think bloody stool and tenesmus are the two cardinal features I think about with ulcerative colitis. And then of course, they can have abdominal pain as well. But now shifting to Crohn's disease, here, oftentimes you don't see as much blood in the stool. You definitely have a significant diarrhea, but not necessarily the component of blood. And I think abdominal pain is a much more of a classic feature of Crohn's disease, particularly because of the inflammation in the small bowel, which can also lead to malabsorption as well as malnutrition. So when you see patients who have evidence of that, they're losing weight, their vitamins are well below the normal reference range, that starts to point a little bit more towards Crohn's as opposed to UC, because again, UC is confined to the large intestine, so there shouldn't be as much issue with absorption of nutrients at that point. And then also for Crohn's, and Walker, I know you'll dive into this in a little bit, but think about the complications you see with Crohn's disease. Generally, these are fistula, strictures, perianal disease. All those features are suggestive of Crohn's disease over ulcerative colitis.
Thanks for just highlighting the importance of a detailed history there, Naveen. Just building on that, another important aspect is always making sure to ask about extra intestinal manifestations of IBD. This is something that I've gained an appreciation for how much this can change things too. And it may even be that a patient would benefit from input from another specialist. So some of the things you could see in either are arthritis, spondylitis, uveitis, some of these inflammatory conditions, but there's some ones that are more likely in one or the other. Specifically, and we'll highlight this a little more later on, always think about PSC or primary sclerosing cholangitis and have a low threshold to do further testing like imaging for that in a patient with ulcerative colitis. So again, always remember considering PSC in patients with ulcerative colitis. It can happen in Crohn's too, but much more likely ulcerative colitis. And so just getting back to, again, some other ways we can help tilt our thinking, whether this is more likely Crohn's or UC, Naveen, what are some endoscopic features that maybe make one diagnosis more likely than the other?
Yeah, you know, we always come back to ulcerative colitis as an inflammatory condition that begins in the rectum. So endoscopically, when we start our evaluation, we'll see evidence of inflammation right from the get-go in the rectum. And typically it's seeing erythema. The mucosa is very friable. So if you just touch the mucosa with your scope on the way of entry, you'll start to see potentially some bleeding. When the inflammation is more severe, you'll see ulceration, you'll see significant mucus. And again, this is generally uninterrupted. This should be uninterrupted inflammation. So you're seeing it throughout, circumferentially and continuously. And as we talked about with the tenesmus symptom, the rectum often has the most prominent inflammation. And so from the moment you start the procedure and you see that inflammation in the rectum, you know you're potentially dealing with ulcerative colitis. Now, contrast that to Crohn's disease, which we've all learned has skip lesions. So as you're doing your colonoscopy, you'll see areas of inflammation, but then you'll see areas without inflammation, followed by areas again with inflammation. So it's skip lesions, oftentimes throughout the colon. And then you can also see this appearance that we call cobblestoning, which is when there are so many ulcers in the colon or the small intestine and they're spaced so close together that it almost looks like cobblestones, like on a walkway. So that's a classic feature of Crohn's disease. Now, we do know that Crohn's disease often manifests in the terminal ileum. So on a colonoscopy, in someone we're concerned with having IBD, we will always try to intubate the terminal ileum to evaluate there for inflammation. And then also remember that any part of the GI tract can be involved in Crohn's disease, classically from the mouth to the anus. So know that you can also have evidence of upper GI Crohn's disease. And so oftentimes an upper endoscopy is warranted in addition to a colonoscopy and evaluation. Now, histology, Walker, you mentioned crypt abscesses in our patients. So yeah, that's a classic feature of ulcerative colitis when we look under the microscope. And the inflammation, remember, is in the mucosal and submucosal area compared to Crohn's disease, where it's transmural. So it's the entire wall of the intestine. And then the classic feature, which we don't always see, but it is helpful when it's there, is the presence of non-caseating granulomas.
Excellent. So thanks for digging into some of that histologic findings too that we may see. And so just to finish out our comparison between Crohn's and UC and touch on briefly some of the complications we need to keep in mind. So with Crohn's, you already touched on this, Naveen. Think about whether the patients had any evidence of stricturing disease, manifestations of obstructive picture, fistulas, abscesses, or sinus tracts. And that's where the exam and even small bowel imaging can be really helpful. And then with UC, in the acute setting, we'll touch more on this shortly, but you do need to think about acute severe UC or toxic megacolon even. And then over the long term, you need to keep that index of suspicion for PSC distinct from PBC, which is primary biliary cholangitis. That is because PSC carries such an elevated risk of multiple cancers, specifically colon cancer, even more so than just the risk associated with UC, as well as cholangiocarcinoma, that we really need to follow those patients closely with help of a hepatologist.
Walker, that's a great point. So just to jump in, so you're saying, and this is a great teaching point, that someone who has ulcerative colitis and PSC is going to have an elevated risk of colon cancer compared to someone who just has UC.
Absolutely, and very significantly so. And so they're actually going to get annual colonoscopy exams. And we really, that is something that you do not want to miss. That's something that changes the patient's outcome and life expectancy. So really important to highlight that. Thanks, Naveen. And now that we are feeling like the most likely diagnosis here, as Naveen said, it could always change, but most likely this is pancolitis from ulcerative colitis. And so then we need to step back and think carefully about our patient's risk factors and their current severity of disease. So for all IBD patients, we need to do this. We need to think about what was their age of onset? What is their disease involvement currently and what was it in the past, both location and phenotype of disease? What was their surgical history? And sometimes that does require going the extra step to dig up outside records as well. And what were their prior medications? What were their medications they were exposed to? What was the duration of them? And what was their response or reason for stopping? And then in terms of like really stratifying the severity, Naveen, you know that there's a lot of specifics here. It's a talk into itself. There's some different classification systems that are more formal, like the Montreal classification or ACG-UC activity index. But here, I just want to highlight the big picture way we think about mild, moderate, or severe disease. So the first thing for a patient with ulcerative colitis that we would think about is, right now, is this patient having an acute severe UC flare? And that is specifically defined as having six or more bowel movements a day and at least one sign of toxicity, i.e. tachycardia, fever, anemia, elevated inflammatory markers. And that is going to come with a very specific management plan we should be enacting for that patient. And we need to have, at that point, a high index of suspicion for fulminant colitis. You know, fulminant colitis can actually lead to toxic megacolon and requires serial abdominal exams and really watching this patient closely. That's when the symptoms have changed from intermittent to continuous. Often, patients are more in the mild to moderate range. And so again, this is not typically when you're seeing this clinically, it's not an exact science, but you're trying to get an idea of, is their disease more mild in that are they having four or fewer stools a day and they're remaining without signs of toxicity? Or maybe is it more in this in-between range where they're having some frequent loose bloody stools, but maybe to the extent of four or five or more daily, and maybe a mild anemia, but not these overt signs of severe anemia, some of the other manifestations we've touched on that could come with severe disease. There is an endoscopic score called the Mayo score that basically grades the severity of the endoscopic appearance on a scale of 1 to 3. And so let's just apply this to our patient now. So her diarrhea was progressive, but she was really only having 2, 3, maybe 4 bowel movements a day. And she did have pancolonic involvement and her inflammatory markers were mildly elevated, but her fecal calpro was only mildly elevated. We did not have any sort of deep ulcerations and she's actually an older age at onset over 40, which is a little bit lower risk. And she hasn't had any extra intestinal manifestations of disease. So we're going to go ahead and put her in this middle category, which often happens, or consider her to have moderate disease. During our patient's initial hospitalization, we ended up treating her with steroids and were able to discharge her on a PO steroid taper with then initiation of a 5-ASA2 as an outpatient with the goal of both clinical or symptomatic and endoscopic remission. So let's pause here, Naveen, and just have you speak to the way that you think about induction therapy and maintenance therapy for patients with UC. There's a lot of options. This was always an intimidating topic to me, so I appreciate any ability you can to kind of break it down and simplify it a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. So, you've already introduced this concept of induction. So the idea here with induction is that you want to induce remission in your patients who are currently in an active flare. So with patients who have mild to moderate ulcerative colitis and are considered relatively lower risk patients, typically you can induce these patients with 5-ASA therapy alone. I would say in the case of our patient, because she was more in the moderate category and looks like she was started on steroids as an inpatient, your first goal is really to taper off the steroids as soon as you can. So as she has already been initiated on 5-ASA therapy, I'm going to try to start tapering her PO steroids over the next few weeks so that we can get her on 5-ASA therapy alone. So then the way we think about 5-ASA therapy is that it depends on where the disease burden is in terms of the ulcerative colitis. So if the ulcerative colitis is only in the rectum, and oftentimes we call this ulcerative proctitis, you can get by with just topical 5-ASA therapy. So typically for those patients, we'll put them on a mesalamine suppository once a day. Now, if their inflammation extends beyond the rectum into the sigmoid colon, so we call this ulcerative proctosigmoiditis, those patients, the suppository is not going to reach far enough into the sigmoid area to actually treat that area. So they actually can still get by with topical therapy, but you have to do an enema. So there's a 5-ASA or a mesalamine enema that we typically dose at night so that they can hold and retain the enema overnight, giving that direct topical effect, and then evacuate in the morning. And so we talked about ulcerative proctitis, ulcerative proctosigmoiditis. And then if you have ulcerative colitis that's involving the left side of the colon up to the descending colon, or further beyond the splenic flexure into the transverse and potentially the entire colon, those patients need oral 5-ASA therapy in addition to rectal mesalamine. So typically we'll do both the oral 5-ASA and the mesalamine suppository. So let's say they respond to those initial 5-ASA regimens, then you typically just stay within those same treatment options as their maintenance therapy. So that's the second goal, is that once you induce them into remission so that they no longer having symptoms and ideally no longer having inflammation, then you can move on to this second goal of achieving maintenance, where you, your main goal in this, at this stage of the game, is to prevent them from having a relapse. So that is if everything goes to plan, but as we know, Walker, things don't always go so smoothly. And so sometimes patients won't respond to the 5-SA therapy you start with. And that's typically when you'll bump up and use an oral glucocorticoid like budesonide or prednisone to help induce the remission. And if they are having, if you start tapering the steroid and their symptoms start coming back, then they're basically declaring themselves as steroid refractory and needing something stronger like a biologic, which we'll get to in just a bit.
Yeah, and so the conversation changes then when we're starting to consider step-up therapy, right? So we try the other agents first. And then if the patients are requiring something like biologic therapy, Naveen, this is a complex topic, but what are some broad categories that you think of for these agents? And how do you have those conversations with patients about risk-benefit?
Yeah, and I think there's two ways to arrive at the biologic therapy. It's those patients with mild to moderate disease who are not responding to 5-ASA and the steroid taper, like we mentioned before, mm-hmm. or it's the patients who come in with severe disease and you know that they're not, that 5-ASA strategy is not going to be effective for them. So kind of two ways to arrive here, and then remember that in these patients who have more severe symptoms, steroids are going to be a cornerstone of the initial induction of remission, and so most of these patients will be hospitalized, requiring IV steroids, and then initiating the steroid sparing agent, which years ago, there weren't many options, but fortunately now, I feel like every year there's something new, right Walker?
the most recent drug, Skyrizi, has a great name to it. So yeah, any IBD doctor who's been doing this for a while will be the first to tell you, right? Just 10, 15 years ago, there weren't many options and it was a less complicated topic to learn. And now, thankfully, we do have a number of classes that we can reach for, which is great for patients.
Exactly. So just for our listeners, I think it's helpful just to know kind of the general classes of these biologic therapies. So you have the anti-tumor necrosis factor or TNF biologic agents, and those are the ones that are probably most commonly known in the treatment of IBD, infliximab or Remicade, adalimumab or Humira, and then more recently, golimumab was recently introduced into this group as well. And so usually with these agents, these biologic agents, you'll also start an immunomodulator like azathioprine or methotrexate. And so oftentimes you see those in conjunction with the anti-TNF. Now, another category of biologic includes the anti-integrins, such as vedolizumab. And there's also anti-interleukin therapy like ustekinumab. And some of the newer agents are JAK inhibitors like tofacitinib. So it ends up being a lot of different agents. But I think it is helpful to think about what category your patient is on, just to know what other options exist if they fail within that category. And yeah, it's a big conversation to have with patients because you really are immunosuppressing them. And there's also a slight elevation in risk of malignancy, dermatologic malignancies. These patients need to have annual skin checks. There's a lot more things you have to think about, which you didn't have to with oral 5-ASAs. Those are generally pretty well tolerated. You do have to check liver enzymes and renal function on when you're initiating. But in general, those agents, you can be on them long term and never have an issue. Whereas with these bigger, stronger therapies, you definitely have to be mindful of causing some significant side effects.
Yeah, that's great, Naveen. And I think like many things in medicine, once it gets a little more complex like this, it can be helpful to have them follow with an IBD specialist and also just having those conversations early on with patients about the different ways this could go. One of the characteristics of IBD is it's hard to predict exactly what someone's disease severity is going to be. And sometimes too, you also have to introduce the idea that at some point, if the medical management fails, they may need surgical intervention as well, just so that doesn't come as a total surprise down the road. So speaking of, an update for our patient. So after she's initially started on her 5-ASA, she's doing great with that in the outpatient setting for about a year. In fact, her 6-month colonoscopy at follow-up shows endoscopic healing. And then just as we were alluding to, this often happens in the real world, she has a flare. She calls into your office, really progressed quickly with her symptoms over the prior few weeks and is now having over 10 stools daily with urgency. She is concerned. She's a relatively stoic patient. You're concerned immediately because you remember this idea of acute severe UC flare, and you recommend that she go to the emergency department, where in fact she gives them a clear history that she's having over six stools a day. She has some of these signs of toxicity we talked about. She's tachycardic, and this warrants, as Naveen was alluding to, inpatient admission with inpatient management. And this is a systematic way that you need to have a checklist if you're on the team managing, helping manage these patients, to go through and make sure you can give them the standard of care that'll give them the best chance to have a good outcome, because this is a serious GI diagnosis to come into the hospital with. So Naveen, just walk us through kind of, you know, diagnostics and therapeutics you want to be thinking of right out of the gates here when you're taking care of acute UC.
Absolutely. And I just want to underscore before we dive into the details that these patients, although they're not like the unstable upper GI bleeds that we've talked about before, mm-hmm. the variceal bleeds, they definitely warrant urgent attention, because a good portion of them will not improve with steroids, will need to be escalated to biologic therapy in-house. And then of those, a good portion will actually need to undergo total colectomy during this same admission. So just because these patients aren't the typical GI emergency cases we think of, that doesn't mean we don't need to not act quickly. This is definitely something that we need to take care of on a more urgent basis.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. And I'll just highlight from my experiences, you know, a resident and fellow, you know, recently going through my training, I think that one of the things I've been humbled by is that this presentation changes quickly. And so your assessment and your abdominal exam is really important to get right away and then continue to monitor closely to watch for these complications. And that way you can get the right steps done that you need to for them. So what initially are you going to send off kind of diagnostic wise, Naveen?
Yeah, nice. So I'm, you know, definitely when I'm seeing the patient, I'm checking the vitals very carefully. I'm examining them, looking for any evidence of peritonitis or concern for perforation. Initial labs, I think a complete blood cell count is very helpful. Obviously, you'll check kidney function, liver enzymes, inflammatory markers, ESR, CRP are readily available. We'll often send a fecal calprotectin, but that does take a little bit to come back. So I think the ESR and CRP give you a much, much better sense of how much inflammation is going on more immediately. And then, you know, these patients, they still should have stool studies in addition to the fecal calprotectin. They should have infectious stool studies sent. C. diff is very commonly mm-hmm. seen in patients with IBD, so very important to check for that, as well as just a general stool culture. And then I have a pretty low threshold for imaging based on how the exam is going. If they have any significant abdominal pain that I can reproduce and I'm concerned at all for potential toxic megacolon or even a perforation, a KUB will be a start, and then a CT abdomen pelvis will definitely give the more readily available information on how extensive the colitis is. And then you have to think about doing an endoscopy. And the key thing here is that mostly, Walker, you know this from last year, we don't do a full colonoscopy on patients who are coming in with an acute UC flare, because the risk of perforation is quite high if we are going through a very inflamed colon. So what's your experience, Walker, from last year? What would you usually start with?
Often we'll start with a flex sig, right? Because honestly, clinically at this point, you're thinking, assuming the C. diff's negative, you're like, this is most likely their disease flaring. But one other diagnosis that admittedly, this came up a couple times this year where we didn't get the flex sig initially, and you should, to rule out CMV on biopsies. That is a cause of a patient's presentation with known UC to change like this. And so that way you've done your kind of full infectious workup, and you know, you've endoscopically graded the disease, knowing that it may still be, like at this point, a Mayo 3, right? The most severe endoscopic grade. And that can inform your next steps in management when you have that stuff pending.
Yeah, that's great. I can remember a few times where I was the GI attending with a fellow, and I had the IBD specialist come in. And as we're moving through the sigmoid colon and seeing the extent of the severity of inflammation, the IBD specialist at that point says, what's the point of pushing further, right? Like, you can get the biopsies right there. You'll get the information you're looking for. And there's no reason, it's not going to change your management.
It's not going to change your decision making.
Yep. Exactly. So that's exactly right. So we'll oftentimes do a flex sig. And then once we've confirmed that infection is ruled out, ideally with pathology coming back negative for CMV, as well as the C. diff and stool cultures being negative, these patients need to be started on IV steroids. The dosages vary. I'm sure now, Walker, you're at UNC, I'm still at the Brigham. Everyone has their regimen, but typically it's IV solumedrol, and a common dose you'll see is 20 milligrams, Q8 hours. And then once you start the IV steroids, generally patients should start feeling better. It may take a few days, but you should start seeing improvement. And you're also hydrating them, repleting their electrolytes. And very important to avoid any anti-motility agents in someone with a severe UC flare, because you can precipitate toxic megacolon. So, and this is really hard. I mean, I was on inpatient medicine recently, and I think I saw how difficult it is, because a lot of these times these patients are in a significant amount of pain, but you really have to have a heart-to-heart conversation with them and educate about how important it is to avoid opiates, because they really can make things worse rather than better, right?
Absolutely. You know, just one of the other things to highlight while we're talking about, that's one thing that's important to explain to patients. It's also important to explain to patients that even if they're otherwise a young, healthy person, they do need chemical DVT prophylaxis as well. They are really at an increased risk of venous thromboembolism. And again, I've had patients who are like, I'm not trying to do that. But again, you have to, if you explain it with the patient, help them know these are all things you're doing in those first 72 hours to try to do all you can to see if those IV steroids are going to work. And so hopefully the IV steroids do their job. The stool diary that you may be having the patient keep, or the stool frequency the nurses are recording, is improving. The exam is improving. And if the patient improves, then we have one way we can go. And if the patient does not improve at 72 hours, it may be a different next step. And so, Naveen, how do you sort of make that judgment call at 72 hours? And what are those options?
Yeah. And so as we discussed earlier, surgery is going to end up being the only option for some of these patients. So I think it's really important to consult colorectal surgery on admission for these patients so that they can at least meet so that both sides, right, the surgeons mm-hmm. and the patient can meet each other, knowing that this may have to be the ultimate outcome for them. And so timeline is exactly right. I think by the 72-hour mark, you should really start thinking, is my patient getting better? Are they stagnating, or are they getting worse? For those patients who are getting better, then it's fairly straightforward from there. You then transition them to a PO steroid regimen, and then oftentimes they can go home as an outpatient and follow up with an IBD specialist to typically be initiated on a biologic therapy on an outpatient basis. But then you have the patients who, like I said, are either they're plateauing or they're getting worse. And if 72 hours of IV steroids has not made things better, they typically are trending towards the need of getting loaded with a biologic agent while in-house. And so I'd say this generally happens by day five. We'll give them 5 days to declare themselves. But if by day five they're not improving, then it's time to move forward with a biologic agent, typically infliximab, and will load in-house. And the dosages, it's just helpful to mention, because if you're working on the wards, you'll see these dosages. So the typical infliximab load is 5 milligrams per kilogram at week zero, and then again at week two, and then at 6 weeks. And then they start a maintenance regimen after that. Now, some patients will get that first dose of 5 mg/kg as an inpatient, but then not improve. And so they will then be given a second dose at 10 mg/kg. Generally, this is now at day five if no response. So this would be someone who at day three got infliximab, they're still not better, then they get loaded again with a higher dose. And if still no response, those patients are essentially gonna need to go to surgery with the colorectal surgeons. I should mention, Walker, I don't know if you had an experience last year of using IV cyclosporine. Did you come across that?
Yeah, just a couple of times. And just know that it's another option between steroids and surgery. There are basically two options: infliximab at a couple different dosing regimens. But just remember, infliximab's one of the biologics, if especially at a loading dose, it may be able to work relatively quickly. And then cyclosporin is the other option. And we can probably leave it at that. If you do have a patient like this, the GI team should be following very closely, and each institution will probably have an individual protocol they follow for that dosing.
Yeah, I think that's great. So remember that your patients who are steroid refractory, not improving, should be started on an infliximab load, that if they don't respond to that initial 5 mg/kg dose, they'll then get reloaded with a higher dose of 10 mg/kg. And if they still fail that, then you're left with either cyclosporin or surgery. And I think in most cases, those patients will just go to surgery at that point.
Fantastic. So this has been a lot, and I just want to reassure the listeners that this is IBD can be an intimidating topic with a lot there, and especially with all the biologics. And so for the trainees, I just, you know, want to conclude our case. And then Naveen, have you highlight some of the broad takeaways here? And remember that this is a topic, there's a lot of resources you can look up and guidelines that are helpful, but just remembering the main themes. And so let's just conclude with our patient who initially failed 5-ASA therapy for what was initially more moderate ulcerative colitis and then presented with severe ulcerative colitis. And after a couple of days of IV steroids, it became clear we're likely going to need to start infliximab. And so we induced with that. And then she did fortunately achieve, again, symptomatic remission with the infliximab maintenance therapy as an outpatient. And so Naveen, just take us through the couple broad takeaways you want our listeners to learn.
Yeah, I think so. The first pearl is to spend the time up front using your history, your physical exam skills, to do your best in distinguishing UC and Crohn's disease. It's often difficult in the initial presentation, but especially if a patient has a more longstanding history, if they're showing complications of either disease, if they're showing extraintestinal manifestations, use that information to help you tease apart, is this UC or Crohn's disease? Because ultimately, if you end up with a patient who requires surgery, it's going to be very important to know, do they have UC or Crohn's for their definitive management? The second pearl I want to leave you all with is think about treatment of IBD from the two goals that we stated initially. The first goal being induction. So that's when you want to induce remission. And the second goal being maintaining that remission. And then to follow once those patients are in remission, it's really important to, we didn't have time to really talk about this, but there's this goal to achieve endoscopic remission, which is considered the gold standard for really knowing that your patient is no longer having any residual inflammation. So that is what happens once someone is now in maintenance phase, to then have an endoscopy or colonoscopy to confirm pathologically that they remain in remission. So again, think about the goals: induction, maintenance, and then confirmation of endoscopic remission. And the last pearl is to think really critically when you have a patient coming in with an acute IBD flare, in our case with severe UC, this is an urgent GI problem that may require a surgical intervention. Remember that IV steroids are the cornerstone, but if they're not improving, do not leave your patients on IV steroids for days and days. You need to then transition to the inpatient loading of a biologic agent. And if they fail that, even with the higher dose, then it's time for them, unfortunately, to proceed to the definitive surgical intervention.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Naveen, for taking the time to talk today. And just to wrap it up, I'll say that, you know, any IBD doctor or any GI doctor in general will tell you this can be a challenging disease to manage. Often patients' disease prognosis changes and they may fail medications, but they will always universally be so grateful for you for taking the time to really manage them carefully. And it's really meaningful when you can help these patients out because it affects them every single day of their life. And with that, we'll conclude. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Please tune back in and join us on Run the List for further episodes.